Welcome to the Health and Happiness Show on KGVM 95.9. This is Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist and show host, along with co-host Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. The show is brought to you by KGVM and the Public Education Committee of the Montana Psychological Association. We cover topics that address health and happiness. If you have a group or person supporting mental health needs, contact this station, KGVM. We'd love to tell your story. And now here's Suzanne to introduce today's topic and guest.
Looking over recent information from the leading authorities, the CDC, the Department of Education, the American Psychological Association, the surveys they have provided tell us that we may need to give our young folk a great big warm hug. At least 18 to 20% of all school kids are experiencing mental health difficulties. This mirrors a mental health survey in Montana a few years back that showed 1 in 5 people in Montana have mental health needs. It would certainly behoove us to support our young people just as they're stepping out into the world. And we have with us today Johanna Bertkin to tell us the efforts that are ongoing here in the Bozeman schools. Welcome, Johanna. Thank you for the work you do, and thank you for talking with us today about the efforts.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to be able to share with you what we've been up to.
Well, it's a big job. We're so glad you're there. We had a mother on a few years back whose son was a straight-A student in the Bozeman schools and a wonderful young man. She had no idea, and she lost him to suicide and came on the show to say, parents, do that hug. Be aware if they're sad. And something that we allude to often on the show is that suicide comes about most often not because people really want to die, but because there's pain. And they want to and can't figure out how to get away from that pain. And it's especially true, I would think, you can tell us about that, for young people who are maybe just experiencing some of their first intense pain, and they don't know how to deal with it. And so just one person who could step in and give them hope, show them a way out, help them through that, is going to be golden help. And that's what Johanna does. Johanna, tell us about your ongoing work here in the schools. Maybe before that, tell us how you became interested in counseling.
So I'm a school psychologist by training. And here in the Bozeman Public School District, my title is Student Assistance Coordinator. And in this role, I have the opportunity to work in a lot of prevention efforts, starting with violence prevention, suicide prevention, bullying prevention, drug and alcohol use. A lot of those things that we see is having their core root in mental health challenges. When I was first training to become a school psychologist, I always gravitated toward students, families, people that were experiencing that pain you describe. And some of that pain shows up in schools as externalizing behaviors, little kids who are frustrated, angry. We'd see our fair share of kids who are throwing chairs or, biting, screaming. And I found that there was so much humanity in those situations. And the more that I saw them, as opposed to, I think, many people in the school district who, right now, the major cause of burnout among teachers is the behavior problems we see. And I saw it that and thought, I want to be more involved. And that's what kind of drew me toward prevention work in general. And the more you talk about those outcomes like drug and alcohol use or school violence, the more it becomes clear that the one thing that underlies all of those issues are mental health challenges. And a lot of the mental health challenges that are being reported across the nation and sometimes being referred to as the youth mental health crisis, we see here in Bozeman too. It would be wonderful if we were an exception to the rule. Unfortunately, we are not.
We lead the pack.
Yes. And right now, I believe it's still the case that the number one cause of death among young people in Montana is suicide. So unfortunately, it is the parent that you described, her experience is not unique. And it's something that we as a community don't want to tolerate. As a school district, we don't want to tolerate, you know, just to say that this is normal and it's what's happening around the country, you know, that's not good enough.
No.
And we want to do what we can to, that whatever is within our power, to try to address this. And luckily, we live in a community where we have so many people who want to help, that it feels like it's, you know, perhaps something that we could find a way to change.
Well, and what you're saying to me says that you're trying, by helping the students, to also help support the teachers. Because in looking at professions and stress and depression levels, guess which one wins the prize on that one?
Educators.
Teachers.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And that doesn't surprise me. A lot of people who are drawn to the teaching profession are drawn to it because of their empathy, because they want to make a difference in the world, because they're looking for their own purpose and sense of belonging. How do I make a change for the better? How do I, you know, find a role for myself in a young person's life? And when days and years go by and you're looking at the students and you don't feel like things are getting better the way you'd like to see them get better, it can be extremely disillusioning. And I think many of the educators that I work with on a regular basis are experiencing almost like a moral injury.
Yes.
From continuing to see children suffer.
And we seem to have a real edge for that here in Montana. So are you seeing that we have enough counselors in the Bozeman schools, or do we need more? Where are we on availability of these services?
Mm-hmm. Well, my personal perspective is there's no such thing as enough. We could fill our schools with mental health SWAT teams, and we would still have children who are struggling. What we do have currently in our school district is we have at least one school counselor per school. Mm-hmm. At our high schools, we have four school counselors at each Bozeman High and Gallatin High. At our middle schools, we have two school counselors at CJ, our Chief Joseph Middle School, and Sacagawea Middle School. And then each of our elementary schools has one school counselor, depending on student population. And these people, they're truly lovely. We are so lucky to have the professionals, the dedicated professionals that we have here. It was just School Counselor Appreciation Week last week.
Okay.
So shout out to our school counselors. We really are lucky to have the expertise and empathy that those folks bring to our schools. What we're trying to accomplish now, given the, you know, what is within the my power to control, or you know, that we're is trying to reframe the model that we work with in order to make sure that students are getting the supports they need with the existing staffing we have. So like I said, you know, if there's ever a need for advocacy to bring more staff and mental health support into our schools, I'll certainly be a part of that. But we are also operating with the idea that, you know, there is not going to be a sudden influx of money coming down from the federal government or from the state government anytime soon to support these initiatives. And we can't wait for the day that that happens.
As a matter of fact, I had looked up some information about resources for the needs of our kids, and I'll just go over that real briefly. This is from the Department of Education, and it's giving us kind of a bird's eye view of what has happened. Hang on just a second here.
You take your time.
While I pull that up. Here we go. Yeah. From the U.S. Department of Education, nearly one in five students attending public schools utilizes school-based mental health services. And schools receive support for providing mental health services in several ways. This includes at the federal level through the Department of Education and the Department of Health and Human Services. And there was a recent federal measure, the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act of 2022, that included provisions to support and expand school-based mental health services, providing $1 billion to increase the number of mental health providers in schools and provide training. However, in April 2025, under the Trump administration, the Department of Education announced the cancellation of these funds. Additionally, President Trump signed an executive order in March, just March, of 2025 to dismantle the Department of Education, an entity which has developed guidance regarding school-based health services that helps to support mental health, anti-bullying, and trauma prevention intervention. Ouch.
Yeah, that certainly hurts. It's something that even when fully funded, we knew we had to make improvements. A lot of people point to COVID-19 as being a starting point for many of these mental health issues that we're trying to address. If you look back at the data, it's been longstanding.
Did exacerbate, according to what I'm seeing, somewhat. But it's always been there, and that was where COVID was able to dive in and irritate it even further.
Yeah, and I would have hoped that that experience, it was a visceral encounter with, you know, the fragility of our, you know, support networks, of our mental health infrastructure, specifically for young people. And I was hopeful at the time, and I continue to, despite all the bad news, continue to harbor some hope that there will be an increasing recognition of the need for mental health supports, specifically for our young people, and that this is something that we owe them.
Well, as a matter of fact, when COVID was blooming, we made a visit and had a show with the counselors at the new high school about how they were being able to discuss among themselves and figure out what to do to help the students. And they had worked so diligently and developed a program whereby they could talk to students at home, online, and they could counsel in various ways that didn't require face-to-face treatment. You know, they were really proactive in trying to do everything they could. We were so proud of their excellent professional efforts. Yeah.
I'm glad you got to meet them. Like I said, they're
great team.
Really lovely people, and creative and dedicated, and there's a lot on their plates. And that's one of the things that we're trying to address in the with some of the efforts we're taking as a district. So right now, I'll give some context. Last year, we had a student well-being committee, where we met and looked at some of our local data on mental health that indicated, like national data does indicate, that we have a significant problem. Among our high school students in our Bozeman High School and Gallatin High School, they answered the question, during the past 12 months, did you ever feel so sad or hopeless almost every day for 2 weeks or more in a row that you stopped doing some usual activities? At about a 40% of our students endorsed that question. And so as a result of this committee, we made some recommendations, including the adoption of a extremely ambitious long-term strategic goal for the district, which is that we have a goal in reading, a goal in math, and now we have one for both student and staff well-being. But that goal is to reduce depression rates among our students to below 15% from that 40% mark. Mm-hmm. And in order to do this, we recognize not only is that going to take significant efforts in schools, but also it's going to take some community-based organization and, really trying to leverage some of the things that make Bozeman, Montana really special.
Which brings me to one of the questions I had. Can you use volunteers in this effort? People out there listening, might have skills or might be willing to do some training to be helpful. Is that something the schools do at all?
Mm-hmm. We do. We have a couple of different ways that community members can volunteer. One of which is we have Project Connect, which is a program that has parents come mm-hmm. into our schools to provide additional supervision, relationship, and support for our schools to make them feel really community-based. Mm-hmm. That is one avenue for volunteering. Another is a collaboration we have with Thrive, the organization that has, they have parent liaisons in our buildings, which are also a wonderful support network. But there's also CAP Mentors, which are volunteers from the community who want to have a relationship with a student, and they come in on a regular basis. They're matched with a student buddy, and they provide mentorship and relationship, and seeing some of our kids really blossom with that added attention has been a really encouraging experience. So the more we can expand that, the better.
And I'd like to just throw in there that volunteering, you don't need to be learned or don't need to be older. When we moved here, we heard that Bozeman's average age is 26. How about some of the college students and young people coming over to mentor? What a good use of time. Older people, of course, have a lifetime of wisdom to share, mm-hmm. or even some of our non-wisdom times might be more informational. Volunteering. I can't think of anything that would make you feel better. Mm-hmm. And that reminds me of something you and I were talking about a few minutes ago. We were talking about two young men that didn't have anyone in their lives at all. There wasn't a special family member, not a grandparent or a parent. There wasn't a loving neighbor or friend. No one at school connected with these two young men. And it was written about in a book called The Moore's Murders. They were so unattached to society as we know it that they went in and systematically murdered an entire family in a nice home, the kids, the parents, anybody who was in that home. And they later talked about how they really didn't feel anything. So the point that was made in all the research and effort to find out what went wrong was that they didn't have anyone who cared to help them. So if you as a volunteer out there could come and help one kid, That would just be amazing. And what did Yuri Bronfenbrenner say?
Everybody needs someone who's crazy about him or her.
I couldn't agree more. And I think this is one of the hypotheses, at least, for the youth mental health crisis, is that connection is one of the most powerful things that we can have in our lives. It's a stabilizing force. Relationships are how we develop values, sense of purpose, sense of belonging. And one of the reasons that people, this is a guess right now, but it seems like there's some supporting evidence that with the proliferation of a media-based childhood or an online childhood, our young people are experiencing a type of disconnect from their communities and from their schools and from the healthy adults in their life, mm-hmm. that is contributing to this sense of disillusionment and feeling unwell, or contributing to feelings of anxiety and depression. And one of the initiatives that came as a result of our well-being committee was the Youth Resilience Project, which is something that we're working on promoting this year and really getting off the ground at the beginning of next year. But the Youth Resilience Project is a collaboration between the Bozeman Public School District, the Bozeman Schools Foundation, and a couple of other community donors, some of whom have had the unfortunate experience of losing their own children to suicide. And with these partners, the goal is to create mental health training modules that are really for anybody. It's really accessible, easy to understand. Mm-hmm. And we would like to see our community organizations get trained using these common sense, simple modules. And once we have a decent number of our youth-facing organizations or youth-facing staff in the community, really what we will have done is to increase the baseline of our shared understanding of mental health and our responsibility as healthy adults to the children that we work with. So what we're trying to do is promote this among coaches, among Boy Scout groups, among children's theater organizations, and even employers. So I'm thinking, a Wendy's franchise who employs many of our high school age students would get their staff trained in Youth Resilience Project modules. And those organizations that have at least 80% of the staff trained would get to bear the shield. We have a cute little logo that's a shield logo. And they could put that in their promotional materials, put it on their website, put it in their email signatures, so that parents, community members can know that, hey, if I'm signing my kid up for this opportunity or this extracurricular activity, they're going to be working with adults who are aware of mental health issues, know how to be a healthy adult role model, navigate social issues, stress, anxiety, and also know what to do if there's a real concern that a child may be struggling.
Identification is so significant. So any person who has a relationship with the young person could pick up on these signs, could give them that ray of hope they need, help redirect them to a solution rather than some of their gloomy first thoughts. And so I love the way you're setting up training situations that just help people know some basic information that empowers them to recognize teaches them to know where to turn when this happens. And I know there are other community and state organizations that help. Carl Roston, for instance, who worked so hard to help the schools with these significant problems. So all of us need to gather together and work on this. Mm-hmm. And Arliss will tell you, there aren't enough psychologists, school psychologists, counselors. There's a real shortage across the state. So kind of maybe tell us about your training and intrigue some people out there to go back to school, or is there starting school to study and become a helper here? And Arliss is going to talk about psychology, too.
It truly is a fulfilling career. No 2 days are the same. And there is such a need. Just to emphasize your point, one of the things that we do have in our schools are, we have a program called CSCT, and also SBOTS, both of which I will explain. SBOTS are school-based outpatient therapists. And then CSCT is a similar model, but it involves family counseling as well. And these are people who are trained as therapists that are working in our schools that we could refer students to in a situation where, you know, it's more convenient and or more appropriate to provide those therapeutic services in a school setting. There was a time not long ago where we had full teams of therapists and behavior support folks at each of our schools. We have not been able to keep those positions filled. There's a really high turnover, and the folks that used to have the position that end up leaving, it's almost uniformly due to cost of living and what they're able to make in that role.
And so you went to college, and then what all was involved for people out there who might be interested in doing what you do, and we hope you are interested, and listen to this. Yeah.
Yeah. I got my bachelor's degree from University of Colorado at Boulder, and I got a bachelor's degree in psychology and sociology. And then I got my graduate degree, or a master's, from CSU Chico in California in applied psychology. And then there's a credential that you can get that allows you to operate as a school psychologist. And I think that what drew me to that is that it really is just creative problem solving. A combination of creative problem solving and empathy and human connection. And if there was ever a job that really embodies purpose, it's this one. And I'm sure the counselors that are on our school teams feel the same way. It is sometimes challenging, but the rewards of being in a profession where, you know, bad things are happening all the time, and I like to think of it as that there are only so many people that are willing to look them in the face and say, every day I'm going to do something about it. And of course, that's not everybody, and it shouldn't have to be everybody. Mm-hmm. But for the people that, you know, really are searching for a sense of purpose in dark times, I've found that this has been more rewarding than any other type of career I can imagine. Sometimes when it's hard, I pretend to imagine a world where I've, you know, become a computer programmer or, you know, some other outcome. Uh-huh. And I know it wouldn't give me the same things that this can give you.
You mentioned earlier something I find fascinating is the term moral injury. Mm-hmm. I do a veterans evaluation, so a lot of them about PTSD, and that is right in the center of PTSD. So in many ways, what psychologists, counselors, teachers suffer after making all this effort, expending all the energy, physical, mental, emotional, is that they really get burned out or could get burned out and even have moral injury from just seeing how could the people possibly feel that way or do that to each other. Or that allow a situation to exist. What is there available for you guys, teachers?
It's a great question, and I think that's another something else that the school district is really trying to address. Like I mentioned earlier, we have a student well-being goal, but we also have generated a staff well-being goal in response to some of the data that we've seen about staff well-being. And when I say staff, I mean certainly teachers, but also our principals, our paraprofessionals, our lunch staff, our bus drivers. I think that, you know, when you're in a situation where you see bad things happening, you want to be able to make it stop. And sometimes we don't have the resources to be able to do that.
You feel the helplessness and hopelessness of that sometimes. Yeah. But you do what you can.
Yeah. Try to do what you can while not bringing it home or or suffering from, like you mentioned, a secondary stress injury. It's certainly a problem here, and it's a problem everywhere at all of our schools, to want to be able to help so badly and not either have the tools to do so or the, you know, the structures in place that would allow us to do so. Like, you know, it, money from the federal government to fund some of these programs. You know, I think that when we have teachers who look at a child who is struggling and they say, you know, who do I refer them to? How do I get them the help they need? And then there are barriers like insurance and, you know, waiting lists to get an outside therapist. And it really feels like a sort of impotence that is psychologically damaging.
Yeah. And I think at this point, we could say that we need to point out that if somebody out there has a child they're concerned about, to come and speak to the counselors or call 411 or call the help center. They provide counseling help free of charge. So that, and also Community Health Partners provides counseling. So there are some agencies, and they also support the schools, and they would support the parents. The schools are working as hard as they can and unable to see to do as much possibly as they would like. But you can hear from the programs and the efforts that they're doing a mega job of making the effort to do what needs to be done.
I wanted to ask, since we read a lot and there's some research being done on the negative effect of media, cell phones, all the different apps, how do you guys manage that in a realistic way?
It's a great question and a timely one. In addition to some of the other things I mentioned from our well-being committee, one of the other recommendations that the board has approved is to move to entirely cell phone free high schools. Right now, we have cell phone restrictions at our elementary and middle schools that are working with various to various levels of success. But we would like to see our high school age students at least have a break from the apps during the day. Some of the more recent research shows that a typical high schooler during a school day, so from, you know, 8:30 to 3:30, receives 250 push notifications. So that would be dings or buzzes or, you know, something coming
up. Distractions.
Total distractions. And they've shown that even having the cell phone on your person, even if you're not looking at it, undermines academic performance, undermines social engagement. So last year we had a big move to create cell phone free classes. So when high schoolers come in, they relinquish the cell phone to a cell phone caddy where it is kept separate from them during class time. Then they retrieve that cell phone and they're on it during passing periods, during lunch, almost every other waking minute. It's actually a fascinating sight. I wish I could give folks this image, burn it into their brain, because it's certainly burned into mine. But when you walk around a high school campus at lunch, what you'll see is kids by themselves looking at their cell phones, and sometimes when they're in a group interacting with each other, the way they're interacting is that they're looking at their screen and then they're showing their friends the screen, and the friends will look at a video on their phone and they'll share that video. But the communication, the eye contact, the okay. It's just not there. It's mm-hmm. totally changed childhood.
Mm-hmm. The interpersonal mm-hmm. has gone by the wayside.
Absolutely. And it's in my mind, that is one of our responsibilities as a school, is we're not trying to just provide students with the type of education that, you know, will get them into a good school or land them in a good job, but with the social skills and the social resilience and that's needed to help them live healthy, fulfilling lives. And that often takes interacting with peers, and sometimes those interactions will be negative, but how to persist through those negative
That's a learning process that's needed as well.
Absolutely. Mm.
And interestingly, the innovation that's been so great with all the electronics and computers and apps, mm-hmm. These innovators are also creating ways around that. For example, glasses mm-hmm. that have basically everything, and you don't necessarily need to be verbalized to get to read or look at it. Or maybe a real bug in the ear that's real can't be seen. So yeah, it's a challenge.
It is a challenge, and again, maybe this is silly of me or naive of me, but I do feel hope on this front too. That there's been an increasing recognition of the ways that cell phones and social media have changed childhood, and a reaction to it mm-hmm. By many of our parents. We recently did a survey of our parent and student population asking about the cell phone-free policies in the district. And our parents, so there was a Likert scale, mm-hmm. scale from strongly opposed to mm-hmm. Strongly support.
So 0 to 10, 0 to 5.
0 to 5. So uh-huh. there's some middle ground in
yeah,
there.
Uh-huh.
But not according to our parents. Our parents responded in a way that they were either strongly opposed or strongly in support. About 50-50.
Oh, no.
Which is...
I would have thought you would have much more support.
And, you know, that was my intuition, too. But if you look into it on a national level...
Emergency.
70%. Of parents are opposed to a cell phone free policy.
I would like to
because
just
of emergency.
Because of emergencies.
Here
mm-hmm.
that
school
we
shootings.
Mm-hmm. were visiting our family recently, and we rode to school with our granddaughter, who's in middle school, mm-hmm. on her way to school, and they have a phone bag. They put their phone in it, and they put it in a box or a container, and they all put their phones in there as they get to school, mm-hmm. and they get them back at the end of the school day.
Mm-hmm. There are some tech innovations that are making this feel more possible. So I think that the product you're describing, it may have a number of different brand names, but if folks wanted to look up what that looks like, it's the one I'm most familiar with is the Yonder Pouch. And it's basically a little, you know, Teflon bag mm-hmm. with a magnetic opening, and you mount magnets around the outsides of the schools. So when they leave for the day, or, you know, if you have a senior that's driving off campus for lunch, they leave campus with their pouch and unlock it using the magnets and mm-hmm. mounted on the outside of the school, and they have access to their phones. So that is one of the potential options that we've been investigating. Our high school principals even went on a little field trip to go look and see what that looks like at a school mm-hmm. that is using Yonder Pouches. Mm-hmm. So we've been doing some...
checking into that same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder, I think the question parents might have is that it's a safety factor mm-hmm. for their child to have
Certainly.
That phone. Oh, if something comes up, they could reach me, call mm-hmm. me. But maybe if each classroom had an emergency phone,
mm-hmm.
I've been thinking about
this. They probably do.
Mm-hmm.
So that parents could be put at ease that there is a safety factor and there is communication with the outside world from that classroom should something come up. But that you'd like it to be more rare than it is. But,
of course.
But I think all of us are dealing with those realities. So I don't think that should preclude having sanity in the schools when it comes to cell phones, beeping our children incessantly, distracting them, reducing their cognitive ability to function educationally. I'm sorry, that doesn't equate for me.
What is the protocol for that kind of emergency?
Oh, there are many. And I'll share, I have sort of a unique perspective on this. One of the things that I do in my role as student assistance coordinator is I am a co-coordinator of our crisis response team. So a crisis response team in a school district usually refers to mental health triage, but I'm also a part of our regular tabletops exercises that we do to prepare for active emergencies, ranging from, you know, fire, gas leak, environmental events, all the way to active shooter situations, violence on campuses. And I one of the things I really hope to do as we implement these cell phone restrictions or broaden our cell phone restrictions to some of the passing periods and lunch is to provide reassurance and try to build trust around these protocols that we have in place. I think many families are aware that there's maybe something for that, but maybe not to the extent that we are doing this many times a year, running through exercises, coordinating with our school resource officers, Bozeman Police, FEMA, Red Cross. We have many of these things that we've practiced over and over again. And while, you know, there's a part of me that feels like this point isn't even worth making, because the emotional connection to having your child be able to contact you in an emergency is such, I mean, there's no argument that would change the way somebody feels about the idea that, you know, if there's something happening at the school, that they can text their child and their child can say, "I'm safe." You know, there's nothing that replaces that. But I think that's what many parents are thinking about when they feel resistance to cell phone policies. And one thing that I think helps me is framing it this way. We are exchanging a known danger. Being online all the time is impacting our kids' mental health. We have enough research now to show not only just a correlation between time spent on the phone, but causation. And this is from the time you're little to the time you're an adult. Some of the research about when you're little is especially striking. Each additional 10 minutes a child spends on a phone, that's 10 fewer vocabulary words that they know. But then thinking about, you know, so we're exchanging this known danger for an unknown and unlikely danger. And I know the way that school shootings are publicized makes it feel constant. And frankly, any is unacceptable. I agree. However, the place where gun violence most often occurs is in the child's home. And shootings in other public areas are more common than in schools. But because there's such an emotional, visceral reaction to when they happen with such a soft target, it's a different emotional experience when it's reported on. But restaurant-based shootings are more common than a school-based shooting. But part of the problem, what we're up against is, you know, we have many elementary school kids, their parents are giving them watches or phones really early on and saying, "You need this for your safety." And then for us to take that away and say, "Actually, no, we can keep you safe," that's a contradiction that I think many children and many families can't understand. But if you look at what the real research behind having a cell phone in a crisis like this, it does not practically make kids any safer. It is a psychological reassurance for parents. But they found that, you know, when kids are using cell phones when there is an active shooter on campus, they're more likely to be discovered. We have protocols about how to keep kids hidden, how to keep quiet. And when you have cell phones going off, it's a risk. Mm-hmm. We also have done tabletops where we've learned the reality of one of these situations. Cell phone towers go down almost immediately. And If kids are trying to text, it's actually getting in the way of communications to emergency services. If they are able to reach their parents, the first thing the parents do is they show up at campus, and that crowds roads so that emergency services can't get to where they need to be. And the first thing that we do in a situation where there's danger on campus is we transport the students elsewhere. So ultimately, if the parents are arriving at school and we're taking the kids and bringing them elsewhere, it disorganizes the whole system. So again, it's not an argument really worth making that cell phones aren't helpful in these moments because of that emotional reaction, but ultimately they're not making kids safer.
And they are inhibiting learning and progress, definitely daily, ongoing.
And let's mix in AI.
Oh, goodness. Why not?
Talk about developing language or lack of, or writing a paper or not, or now even in the mental health area, people consulting AI for their ongoing current anxiety or depression.
Sure. Uh-huh.
And while there may be some good information, there's some very bad information.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a real person at the other end.
Was it just a week ago or so that AI went ahead and told somebody,
how the effective way of ending your life or something, you know?
It is heartbreaking. I mean, I've heard both sides of this, people who feel passionate that, you know, having any resources available instead of none is better, even if that resource is AI. But where I've heard that AI continually slips up in these conversations about mental health is when there is an imminent risk. And the school district, we're mandated reporters for a reason. If a child is going to self-harm, the parent knows about it immediately, and we are getting that child to support out of an abundance of caution, even if we think it's, you know, not imminent or not the highest level of risk. But because we know that, you know, we are fallible, we perform out of an abundance of caution. AI, I don't know if you've noticed this in your conversations with, ChatGPT or others, it never says it doesn't know.
Right.
It knows everything.
I have, so many of them now. I can't think of the name of the guy that I talked to. He calls me, he can't pronounce the R in my name, but he sounds like a British Ollis.
Ollis, Claude, maybe?
Yeah, well, that discounts totally AI then. You know. Can't pronounce the name. No, I hear you. It's so good to hear that you all are way straightly prepared for emergency situations. And it does seem to me to be a good segue between mental health services and safety precautions in the schools. And I'm so glad you reviewed that for parents out there and other professionals.
Yeah.
I was wondering, too, if you could tell us a little bit about how services in the schools work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you have individual sessions? Do you have group sessions? Do you go into classrooms or maybe all of the above? Kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of how the services actually operate in the schools.
So the model that we implement in our school district for mental health and social, emotional, and behavioral learning is, to the greatest extent, an analog of the way that we deal with academics. So if you get confused at any point, just think about, because it is, I'm about to say a lot of very confusing things, but I realize that in the schools we sometimes use a totally different language that is even unique from regular mental health language psychology. So please call me out if I use any terms that you're not familiar with. But what we do is what we call multi-tiered system of support, which is, in essence, trying to meet the needs of students where they're at. So if you think about it in an academic model, all kids get a specific type of reading curriculum. And if they're not learning to read using this core instruction by the teacher, we would want to know why aren't they learning that skill, and we look at underlying causes, and then we would provide an intervention for those students who aren't acquiring those skills the way we'd expect that is related to the underlying cause. So in reading, sometimes that's phonemic awareness, for example, something you're very probably familiar with as a speech and language path. So we have, if we have kids that are, you know, receiving this instruction, they're still behind, we might have a small group in place by a reading interventionist where they provide small group instruction on phonemic awareness in addition to their the core instruction in reading. And then if they continue not to gain skills or, you know, make up for those phonemic awareness awareness deficits, we start looking at more individualized supports or individualized education plans, special education services for a student if they have not acquired those skills despite adequate opportunity. So we're trying to do the same thing with mental health. So in our schools, elementary and middle right now, at the high school, we're still working on getting this a part of their general structure. But at both of our elementary and middle school levels, we have a social-emotional learning curriculum that teaches essential skills that help students develop coping, help them deal with life setbacks, help them resolve conflicts, solve problems. So a resource on this, if anyone is interested, is CASEL, which is sort of the leading in the industry SEL instruction organization. And they have defined five core categories of skills that students need to learn then that are correlated with long-term health, mental health outcomes. Those things are self-management, self-awareness, relationship skills, responsible decision-making, and I always forget the last one. It's going to pop into my head in a second.
It'll come.
But in elementary school, we use a program called Second Step. You'll see some of these boxes behind me. And at middle school, we're using a program called Wayfinder. And this is instruction that all students that come to our schools will get. I've heard some parents ask, you know, is this, you know, parents were particularly concerned about, you know, mental health and what that means. And this is not mental health treatment. It is instruction in the underlying skills. And it is the skills that you would need to stand up for your values, to advocate for yourself, regardless of your viewpoints. It teaches kids how to disagree appropriately. All of those sorts of things that, you know, if you don't know how to do well, might result in difficulties with emotional health later in life. So we do that, and then if kids do not are not acquiring those skills, as evidenced by, you know, ongoing behaviors or social-emotional struggles or peer conflicts, we have small groups that we pull kids into and do specific skill instruction in things like, you know, resilience or coping tools or, you know, managing emotional regulation. And then similarly, you know, if they still are struggling to gain those skills, we have tier three, which would, so tier one is what everybody gets. Tier two is those small group skill instruction. And then tier three would be more mental health support or treatment or behavior plans or a referral to one of our school-based outpatient therapists or that sort of thing. So with that structure, we are hoping that kids don't fall through the cracks on us anymore.
Tier one, tier two, and tier three. I like that so well. And over a lifetime, I've thought, you know, you can come out of the schools and you can know everything about geometry, everything about history, but maybe not how to get along in a social situation, which will inhibit you in your career and in your socialization all across your life, even in raising children in a heartfelt way.
What's the biggest resistance area you find in parents? I know there's so many diverse opinions and political views and religious aspects. Where's the resistance?
Yeah, and I think a lot of it has to do with what the field of, I think, psychology and mental health has done to itself in a way. Uh-huh. We spent many years sort of mystifying the process. It's a kid being pulled into a room with a therapist, the door closes, some sort of magic happens.
Can't
talk about it. Yeah. The kid leaves fixed somehow.
Yeah.
This is really not that mystical. It's not that hidden. What we're doing really is skill instruction.
Jeff explained it over and over to many parents.
And they think that sometimes if you're reaching out and saying, hey, your kid's been selected for a small group to learn more about coping tools, the reaction many parents have is defensiveness. Like, what's wrong with my kid? Are you saying that they're not, a good person? And that's not it at all. We all need skill development.
There's a word that's come up in recent years which different groups use, well, that's too woke.
Yep.
Like, it's woke if you're teaching emotional health.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow going to lead you to some leftist position of, I don't know. But yes, I hear you. Yeah, you probably have to deal with that quite a bit.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting that you mentioned the woke thing. It's somewhat mellowed out here. I think we've done a good job of saying what it is and what it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there was an initial pushback against the idea of any sort of supports for social emotional learning in school because it was perceived as indoctrination. And that is not the goal. In fact, we have kids with all sorts of political viewpoints, and we want them to be able to self-advocate. We want them to be able to argue for themselves and their worldview without harming others.
And be healthy.
And this was not about politics. Mm-hmm. I assume your efforts were about helping kids navigate a political world, a social world, an educational world, and have the tools they need to go through and be able to function well. And so we should all give you a round of applause for thinking of their hearts and their outlook as well as their academics, because we're losing too many kids because we haven't really approached those aspects of the heart that are so significant in our young people.
We have about 3 minutes. What have we not talked about? For example, I'm thinking, probably opening a whole new area, is sex ed still as sensitive in the schools as it was before?
Great question. That is not one of my areas of expertise, for better or for worse. I do know that there's ongoing different beliefs about where sex ed belongs. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is it something that the school should do? Is it something that should happen at home? I haven't been too involved in those conversations, although I know it comes back up fairly regularly. And my feeling about this is one of the goals of school is to create students that are successful in later in life. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our 21st century skills, career, if you look at employers, what are the types of skills they're looking for? And they're looking for grit, they're looking for resilience, they're looking for social skills, they're looking for, conflict resolution, all of these sort of what we used to call soft skills.
And they're so unsoft in my estimation. These are hard life lessons we all need to be fluent with these things.
Wouldn't it have been nice if I had learned those early on? I find that I'm still learning those lessons. I'm in my late 30s, and every once in a while I'll stumble upon a lesson that we're teaching second graders, and I'll be like, oh,
okay.
That would be great.
Oh yeah. And just recovery too. Okay. We're about out of time here.
But some final words. Give us a final statement in the remaining 30 seconds.
Yeah. I guess my final statement would be is that schools operate on what we call a continuous improvement model, which is we're never done. We are going to continue to look at the things that are affecting our students, and one of those things right now is mental health. And we're going to do everything we can to make our model such that we can catch kids, prevent them from falling through the cracks. And we need all the support we can get from our community to meet our ambitious goals to do that.
Thank you so much. I want everybody to listen to this on Monday night at 7 and Thursday mornings at 9 on KGVM 95.9. Thank you so much.
Thank you.